Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
I hope everyone had a great weekend. Tonight is shaping up to be a two-part series. Next week, we will be discussing with Reverend Michael Carter about ways to overcome trauma and processing a very unusual experience of ET abductions, patterns that emerge after the event, and ways to heal. Tonight's show is going to cover how the people and town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, were traumatized by the Mothman and the Silver Bridge collapse. UFO researcher and host of the High Strangeness Factor and the correspondent for Mac Maloney's Military X-Files, Steve Ward, returns. Joining Steve is psychology researcher Dr. Bill Kousalis. They continue to research the Mothman legacy, and they have been researching the effects of trauma of the Mothman eyewitnesses and the Silver Bridge survivors. Hi, Bill and Steve. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing good. Doing great.
Good. Mark,
nice to be
you.
Here.
Yeah. We're very glad you're here. When we put this show together, it was to promote the Mothman Festival. Unfortunately, it was canceled, Thursday due to, the Delta variant concerns. I feel sorry for the people who make about half their annual salary from this three-day festival. There are more people walking up and down Main Street during those 3 days than live in the rest of Mason County the other 362 days of the year. But there's nothing we can do about that. Just 2 years in a row of lost opportunities. But hopefully tonight's show will continue to generate interest in this fascinating story. Okay. let's start off by looking at how the eyewitnesses were impacted by their sightings. Steve, you've interviewed Linda Scarberry. She was one of the first four people to report the Mothman. Can you give us a little background on her and what your interview was like with her?
It was very informal. What Jeff Wamsley would do, and he of course, is the co-founder of the Mothman Festival and the curator of the Mothman Museum. He, I think it was 2006, that my first Mothman Festival was the first. He had been trying to get Linda Scarberry and some other people to just kind of sit at a table and allow themselves to be interviewed and questioned by the people that attended the festival. And that was her first year. And I didn't get a chance to talk to her too much then. I think it was the next year, 2007. But by that time, she had, it felt like she made her peace with it. But she did talk about how she was very firm that that's what happened. They saw this 6-7 foot sort of humanoid winged creature with red glowing eyes in the TNT area, which is north of Point Pleasant. And this was November 15th, 1967. And it scared the heck out of them. This thing chased them into town. Most people know the story. But afterwards, there was a long interview that Donnie Sergeant Jr. did with her, which is in the first book that he co-authored with Jeff Wamsley called Mothman, The Facts Behind the Legend. And she saw this thing again more than once, and she even saw it sort of perched or sitting on a roof across from where she lived. And at the time, she had so many people that, not just Linda, but so many people around that time that reported this got harassed and made fun of. And so she didn't talk to me much at all about she had a nervous breakdown. I don't know much about the details, but my impression was it was more from the way people were treating her in town than the experience was pretty frightening, and it it happened again more than once. She saw this thing more than once. My impression was, and maybe Bill will have more information on that, was that it was the harassment that really got to her. But by the time I had spoken to her, she was just a great lady and very nice to talk to. I remember the last time I talked to her was I don't know what year that was. It was the year before she passed. She was there with Faye DeWitt, who was another witness. And I didn't even ask them anything about the Mothman. I just asked them how their year was, how things were going.
Mm-hmm.
So, she was someone that overcame a bizarre experience and survived it with a lot of class, I might want to add.
When you spoke with her, did she show any traits of being traumatized, like rapid speech or body language, like folding her arms across her chest? Like that, disorganized thoughts that would indicate that she was getting triggered by recounting the story to you?
Not at all. And the times I spoke to her, she just seemed to be completely at peace and just to really have her life together. There wouldn't have, you know, if I didn't know the history and what she had been through, and the whole sort of folklore and mythos and of the Mothman, I wouldn't have had any clue that she had ever been through such a rough experience.
Bill, when you know, you have advanced degrees in psychology, when we get into studying behavior and trauma, what are some of the other traits that people suffering from PTSD may display?
That's a great question, Mark, and I guess the way that I'd like to speak to that is that as we've spoken about prior to the show, my wife and I and another researcher by the name of Amanda Raber have been interviewing folks who were traumatized by the bridge collapse. In fact, a study that we're working on presently is in and around the bridge collapse and the paranormal phenomena that happened in the Point Pleasant area back in 66, 67. And one of the individuals who we interviewed, who wasn't, she wasn't a paranormal phenomena experiencer. She was just the bridge disaster. How did that affect her life? One of the things that she had kind of illustrated was that she lost her sister-in-law in the bridge disaster. And her brother was present when the car came up with his wife in the car, which I can't even imagine what that must feel like. But she was, at the time, a recent high school graduate. And when we interviewed her and spoke with her, the questions that we asked her, she was able to answer them pretty readily, pretty easily. But probably 40, 45 into the interview, we asked her another question about, you know, other reflections she may have had upon the bridge disaster. And I don't know if it was the timing of the question or perhaps because the other questions that we had allowed her to kind of dig deeper into her subconscious, that she recalled an event that she literally woke up like a day or two after they had found her sister-in-law. She woke up with her brother who had lost his wife, the sister-in-law, giving her mouth to mouth because she had passed out and she'd stopped breathing. Now, the reason I've kind of gone at length to describe that portion of the interview is because that memory had been submerged somehow below, you know, a couple levels of consciousness. And I think that that's one of the areas that trauma can manifest in ways that sometimes when we process things, we're not even consciously aware that there's a memory that's in there. And it might take a little bit to be able to pull that thing back out again because we've had layers of coping mechanisms that we've laid across, you know, as a foundation to our thinking and the way that we process information. And she exhibited that. In fact, we were all kind of stunned when that came out because not everybody just dies in their sleep at 18 years old and wakes up to their brother giving them mouth to mouth because she was in shock and she'd forgotten this. This is something that totally slipped her mind. So, I mean, that's one example of a way that can manifest.
Bill, you mentioned recall, and you know, with two events, like what, 13 months of the Mothman sightings plus all the UFO activity, Men in Black descending on the town, it's had a bunch of weird stuff going, suddenly appearing. and the bridge collapse could be a separate event, or others may argue that they're related. But with these two events, in your research, and this question might be for both of you, how is recall memory playing a factor in what was reported to you two, as well as John Keel, and maybe other researchers that you've been working with or spoken to?
Steve, you want to take that?
Well, are you talking about people that recognize that they've had some kind of missing time? And then they...
Has dealing with Mothman eyewitnesses or someone from the Silver Bridge collapse, have they had problems with recalling these events?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I haven't
spoken
to a lot of people in direct connection to some. I mean, I've talked to some people that, heard the crash and, told me where they were when it happened. I've spoken to some of the Mothman witnesses, and anyone I've talked to hasn't really expressed any problems with trying to retrieve memory that I can think of.
Okay. Bill, how about you? Have you encountered lapses in memory because of these traumatic events?
I think the example that I shared a few minutes ago with a witness whose name was Linda, not Linda Scarberry, a different Linda, was the only one that had like a really pronounced episode of, like a submerged memory. And I think that was trauma inspired from losing her sister-in-law when she was as young as she was. Another thing that Linda had spoken of was that she had literally just gotten off work at 4:30 and was driving to go across the Silver Bridge and came upon it shortly after it had fallen. So that was one of those instances where she was shocked because you don't expect this bridge to have gone down. And then she noticed that it has gone down. And, you're kind of psychologically coming into what's really happening because it's so outside of your experience. There's no way that bridge could have gone down. And then you're looking at it, and it takes a while to become conscious of that. One thing I would say that, I've not really interviewed Mothman witnesses per se. One individual of the eight that we've interviewed so far did have a direct experience, but didn't illustrate much trauma from that. But I do think that, with Keel interviewing the folks that he did back in the 60s, that there wasn't a whole lot of time for them to really forget things unless there were episodes of missing time, which obviously I didn't interview those people back then. John Keel did, but I don't recall him illustrating a lot of instances of missing time or submerged memories due to trauma from encountering this paranormal phenomenon. I don't recall a lot of that.
There's one incident mentioned in the Mothman Prophecies, and was supposed to have been a prominent town official, but he was unnamed. He stepped out on his porch and he saw the Mothman standing there. A majestic Mothman, and then it leaves, but then he realizes he's lost 10 or 15 minutes. So he was in a trance or something while this thing was out on his front lawn, and he had no memory of it, and there was never any record of him trying to retrieve those memories. But there was nothing reported about Now, there is, well, you know, there is this. Not only John Keel, but another researcher from Sweden that went in after Keel discovered that a large percentage of people that saw the Mothman had an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena in their house. Now, I didn't talk to any of those guys personally, but if I had an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena for any reason in my house, that could be very traumatic.
Absolutely.
In the Mothman Prophecies, Keel does talk about the lacunal amnesia. He defines it as loss of the memory of specific incidents or moments in time is a common part of the phenomenon. So I just wondered if there is any, I think Keel seems, when did he write that or publish it? It was like 1975.
Yes.
Prophecies. Well, it was,
yes.
A lot of it was sort of written. I think he was trying to get something, an interest in it several years before. And when his editor, this is according to Brent Rains in his book, John Keel, The Man, the Myths,
mm-hmm.
and the Legends,
mm-hmm.
he got out his tattered briefcase filled with articles and writings and so forth and started to piece it together. So some of it, I think portions of it were probably written several years before before he put it all together.
But one of the interesting things about the Mothman Prophecies, the book, is Keel seemed to be very ahead of his time with some of the research that would later be formulated, recall. Some people do remember events more clearly, others do not. He really seemed to have a very good understanding of human behavior.
Well, you know, he read everything. He read hundreds of books. He said things like, if you want to study about things in the sky, read about flight. Read about, flight dynamics. Read, if you're studying about Loch Ness, read everything about the ocean and the water and the things that live in it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just a quick example here. A lady that contacted me a few years ago, not connected with the Mothman, but she and her husband had a missing time experience. They were standing on their front porch. They saw these strange lights come over, and all of a sudden they realized it was a little bit lighter out because it had been early morning. They're not standing next to each other anymore, and they see this large craft brushing the tops of the trees on their property. So, and then a little bit later, and then they talk about the amnesia thing. This is kind of a kissing cousin to it. They said, well, that's interesting, but they didn't even react to it, and they went back to bed. Later on, she realized they had missing time, and they both realized, boy, that was a strange reaction to such a bizarre incident. But long before, she did retrieve those memories eventually through a hypnotherapist. But in the meantime, because of John Keel and the groundwork that he laid, I asked her all kinds of questions, because Keel was interested in if somebody had an experience, he knew that he needed to ask about their childhood, find out about things like the mysterious phone calls, electrical interference in the house, classic ghost
mm-hmm.
phenomena. This woman saw, her family members near the property saw a strange-looking cryptid. They had, both her sons were experiencing orb phenomena. She saw a shadow person. They were having haunting phenomena in the house. So because of Keel, and some others, Keel advanced this field by a century, I think. It's just the idea that these things do tend to be connected without trying to force a connection. So that's the way I would answer that. It's very important to find out all about the individual and other paranormal phenomena that they've experienced.
I would argue, Steve, that Keel is still, as the things
yes.
that he did and the way he went about his research, he was just amazing with the volumes of things that he read and the volume of work that he published. And he went so deeply beyond, you know, surface appearances like you just spoke to when he talked to people. I mean, one of his favorite expressions was find out what they had for breakfast. I mean, literally break down to the inane, because that helps you to really understand the psychology of the individual and their background.
And the other thing is that, and I tell this to people, that it was his book, Operation Trojan Horse, which came out a few years before Mothman Prophecies, where he really makes that connection. And I was not happy with it. I was one of those people that, you know, there's a lot of people now that don't like Keel because they really, really don't like the message. And so I was very happy in the 1960s with the idea that these things were probably ET and you know, they were investigating us and examining our planet. And if I still had that frame of reference when I talked to this lady from New Hampshire, I would have said to her, well, I hope you make a breakthrough with that hypnotherapist. And you know, maybe we could find out what planet the aliens came from. But I would have missed all the other important things about this particular lady's experiences.
And somewhat related to what you said a little earlier about all these experiences being interrelated, Keel did talk about Morse code-like beeps that came out of car radios, phones.
And out of nowhere sometimes. I think, Bill, I think the Scarberries,
right,
when they were living in a trailer, they were hearing some like electronic beeps outside their trailer.
Yeah, they had so much activity that they came back in with her parents because it was just freaking them out.
And let me give you something else here that might be a partial key to the puzzle. I was talking to a lady on my show not too many months ago, and she talked about an incident. She was had a friend over late one night, and one of them heard the sound of a baby crying. Now, the sound of a baby crying when there's no baby is, I guess, a fairly common aspect of poltergeist phenomenon. And even sometimes some Bigfoot entities sound like the wailing of a baby, for what that's worth. But the thing is, the other person with her heard beeps at the same time. So what do you mean? I'm hearing an electronic beeping noise. Her idea was, which I think is brilliant, is it may have been something like signal and noise. But here you've got the baby crying noise and the beeping, electronic beeping noise, which is something that has been reported in all kinds of paranormal activity. Keel collected a lot of it, but I've never heard someone, you know, talk about how two people heard the different sounds at the same time.
So that could be, in the way that Keel would postulate something like that, is the percipient is receiving that information according to their own frame of reference or what have you, because that's the way they interpret it. But it might be the same signal.
Perhaps. You know that, what was it, the Alexa or whatever, somebody was, there was a name coming over it, and people would hear a different name or a different word.
I remember that.
Yeah. But it was funny because people would hear something different very clearly, but it's coming over this electronic device, and it's got to be, I guess it's got to be the way the individual's processing it, because supposedly it's objectively coming out of the device in one particular way.
Okay. Well, you know, Keel wrote about it, and I think it you might have there are a few examples from the Betty and Barney Hill case of that beeping sound. I think it was coming from the trunk, but there was also Betty and Barney also experienced missing time. And
well, weren't the beeps sort of bookends to their experience? They heard it was sort of like when they were kind of losing, when they started to go into the amnesia section, they heard the beeps, and then toward the end when they're coming out of it, and I think they're driving on the road, and they hear the beeps again, and then Betty says something like, well, do you believe in UFOs now, Barney? And he just kind of laughs, and they've had, you know, it's a point where they really have forgotten this, which was a pretty traumatic experience at the time.
Right. I believe they were driving when they were hearing the beeps. And, doing some research for tonight's show, I was going back through Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. And when he was writing about some of the soldiers that he interviewed in the 80s from World War II, he wrote, in contrast, those who had been traumatized and subsequently developed PTSD did not modify their accounts. Their memories were preserved essentially intact 45 years after the war ended. So it seems like there were are times when people do have a very clear recollection, and other times people do have amnesia. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that is really intrigued by Bill's research was the variety of responses that can be can emerge from some type of traumatic event. So,
I think, Mark, just to speak to that a little bit, I think each individual processes information just a little bit differently. And so when we talk about trauma, you know, you mentioned that these individuals who were traumatized during, you know, the Vietnam War, essentially.
Combat.
Some of them, yeah, it could be different wars, the Iraq War or what have you, that basically they can still recall those memories vividly, as you'd stated. But the scary thing about PTSD is that a similar activating incident, I mean, it could be a car backfiring, could immediately put them mentally or psychologically back into a place where they were in combat and they have an over-the-top type of a response because they have that stimulus still buried within their subconscious, and it activates that PTSD situation.
So, Bill, as you and Steve and your team put together your questions, surveys, interviews, interview questions for people, can you explain a little bit about how you are approaching talking to people for your study?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What we did, Mark, was we came up with a couple of different research questions. And what those research questions were, then they're put into the form of a question. What is the experience of post-traumatic growth from having dealt with the Silver Bridge collapse. And the second one was, what are the dimensions of post-traumatic growth that have taken place as a result of experiencing paranormal phenomena, i.e. the Mothman, the Men in Black, the UFOs, the lights in the sky, et cetera, et cetera. So we used those two questions, and then we formulated a number of guiding questions. And what the guiding questions were, the purpose of those was to open up a conversation with each one of the folks that we sat down with and just basically ask them things along the lines of, you know, what was your daily routine like before the Silver Bridge collapsed? And, of course, we had people from all across the spectrum. We had people who were, you know, 8, 9 years old when this bridge collapsed. There were others that were 15, some that were 25. So they all had varying degrees of experience before the bridge collapsed. But then we asked them, you know, who else was involved? Was your family present with you? And then we asked what happened as the disaster unfolded. You know, can you give us a breakdown of what you were experiencing at that point? And then finally, you know, we had a series of questions that was based around the aftermath of the collapse. And for the folks that wanted to speak about the paranormal aspects, we would kind of segue over into similar open-ended questions that were geared more towards, you know, before the phenomena, what was your life like, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a pretty standard formula, you know, for interviewing people in this type of a context, to get them just basically to open up and talk to us. And the whole idea is to get their experience. We don't want to, you know, interject, you know, what we think could possibly be, you know, what their experience was. We needed to know specifically from them, in their words, how it affected them.
Well, it sounds like it's pretty comprehensive. There's a before and after section that just, I kind of like those parts of tests or photos. It shows some degree of change.
In speaking of change, one of the questions that we asked was, what was your biggest takeaway from going through this experience? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people would have to stop and think. And at first, a lot of the times, they would say, you know, I didn't see anything positive that came from the bridge disaster. But then they would speak to, well, you know what, the community just banded together and really, really helped one another to deal with, you know, this tremendous tragedy that happened in this small community. That was one thing that happened, but it's really interesting when you're working with the individuals, because a lot of times they don't stop to think, you know, how this has really affected them, or to put it into words. And putting things into words the way that what the interviews are designed to do is kind of therapeutic in and of itself too, because it brings some of this stuff out and allows the individuals who went through these difficult times to see the growth that happened as well too. And ultimately that's what we're trying to come up with, is, you know, what good came from this, you know. And that was just one example, was the community coming together.
Yeah. And I have a question for Steve. You have the Mothman making his debut on the scene in November of 66. And you get all these other UFO sightings. It was just like a whole lot of weird stuff going on at Point Pleasant. Keel mentions so many other UFO sightings across the East Coast. And there's a lot more to the book than just what's what was going on in Point Pleasant. But, you know, Steve, you also observed the 1966 Detroit UFO sighting.
Oh yes, it was a flap.
It's all about the same time.
It was just actually a few months prior. That was wasn't just Michigan. I grew up in southeastern Michigan, and it was quite a flap throughout the Midwest. But it was in Michigan it got a lot of publicity because Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was still attached to Project Blue Book, and while he had begun to believe there was something really to this, he still had to kind of straddle the fence because he had those apron strings tied to the Air Force. And he's the one that uttered the infamous phrase, swamp gas. And he was suggesting that some of the sightings in Hillsdale, Michigan, might have been caused by that. But that's, all the press needed. And March. And then the following November, the first big sighting of the Mothman, even before he had a name, came over the wire services, and it went all over the world. And I thought, wow, that is that cool. Winged humanoid chased two couples down a two-lane highway. And I was just a kid in junior high, but, in the wake of all these cool reports and sightings and credible police officers seeing this, that's where my destiny was cast with the advent of the Mothman.
Okay, so it sounds like Keel was being a very thorough and objective reporter by including all of this. There are a couple places he gets into international sightings, but for some reason, in that 66, 67 time period, there just seems to be something going on that elicited an outbreak, influx of sightings. That might be a better word.
Well, there was a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And across the East Coast as well. I was just trying to say something about Keel being really in tune with a lot of the unexplained phenomena that was going on that the mainstream is not going to report on, but he was doing it.
Well, he was pulled into it too, and also in like along Long Island and near where he lived, there was things going on. There were reports from Minnesota. When he was interviewed on Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell, this was when the movie had first come out, and I think it had been a long time since John had granted any kind of an interview about the Mothman. He said the one thing he really liked about the film was it really captured the paranoia he felt. And if you guys remember in the book, there's a chapter that says paranoiacs are made, not born. And a lot of this phenomena seemed to center around him or maybe even have been co-created with him. He thought that perhaps sometimes the phenomena was shaping itself to sort of lead him along or teach him a lesson. And just really briefly, so that people, you keep mentioning how wide in scope this was. The prophecies part of the Mothman prophecies had to do with a lot of these people he was in contact with, the silent contactees that were getting messages they felt were real messages from the Space Brothers or some kind of other intelligence. And sometimes that didn't go well. You know, they would get some prophecies that came true. And then the big one, you know, the Space Brothers are going to come down on the hill and take everybody up, and then nobody shows up. You know, that would be fascinating to follow. I mean, some of those people were just desolated by a sense of abandonment when this contact or this experience ended and, you know, it didn't happen anymore. So, this was just we can just barely cover a little fragment of this, but there was a lot going on that would, you know, fall under, I think, the area of trauma.
The Mount Misery aspect of the Mothman prophecies is one of the most fascinating parts of the book, in my opinion. The portions about J.P. Peril and the alleged space denizens, Agar and Apol, and the interactions that they have with Kiel, you know, over the phone sometime and speaking through Jay Perro while he's on the phone with her. That part of the Mothman Prophecies book just blows my mind. I mean, it's just amazing.
And let's mention, Bill, that if people want to pursue that, there are two other books out that have probably some of the stuff that was cut out of the Mothman Prophecies, called The Big Breakthrough and The Big Blackout. It covers some of the same ground as that area you're just talking about, but there's so much more. And you're right, that's the an area of the Mothman Prophecies that is, you just really can't describe the eeriness of the whole thing.
And you're right. I do also believe that the ambiance of the movie, and I saw the movie before I knew anything about the Mothman. You know, I dove into researching the whole thing after the movie. But the movie itself paints such a tone of foreboding and almost mystical type things happening, which I think Kiel even said that although the movie wasn't spot on to what he did, it really captured the essence and the vibe of what was going on during that investigation.
Yeah, Richard Haddam did a really great job on that screenplay. And I might also add that Brent Rains, I forget the name of the lady. She was a friend of Kiel's. And when Kiel read this script for the first time, she said he was actually giddy. He thought, finally, somebody has at least some of the essence of the book, because I think there had been other attempts that Kiel was very unimpressed with. So Kiel really did seem to be impressed with screenplay and the way that they portrayed the movie.
Richard Haddam really did get it. He did an amazing job with the film because it just, like I said, it captured that whole essence and that whole vibe of what was happening then, even though it wasn't a direct representation of what happened.
Right. And, you know, they couldn't he couldn't do the Men in Black, portray it probably exactly the way it was in the book, because of the, you know, in the wake of the silly Men in Black movies, that people would have made that connection and it wouldn't have been taken seriously.
Good point.
Since both of you have made the trek numerous times to Point Pleasant and been around Mason County, do you have an explanation for why this area is attracting, manifesting, and whatever term, you know, why weird stuff comes to Point Pleasant? Is it the abundance of water with the confluence of the Kanawha and Ohio River? Kiel did mention some of the native mounds. Do you have an explanation? Is there something, like ley lines related to the area?
Well, Bill, one of the first things I thought of when Mark asked that was the confluence of the two rivers. I don't know. I think that maybe there are more of these areas than we think, and there perhaps that some of this is more of a natural state. I mean, there are researchers I know that have gone into the type of geography, the terrain, the whether there's limestone or quartz or whatever, that perhaps they're Bill might have a better idea, but I think it's actually is beyond me as to the why a particular area. You have the you know, a lot of the TNT area, I guess, was a Native American burial ground, a lot of turbulent history, but I don't know. I don't know that any of that really gives us the why as to this stuff happened there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things we can kind of put together and theorize, you know, that maybe it's this, maybe it's that. I do know that in Native American lore that the confluence of rivers is supposed to generate some type of mystical power. I know that there also are burial mounds that are along the riverbanks, very close to the river where the natives had buried mm-hmm. their dead. So, I mean, that conducive to maybe the transmigration of spirits along the rivers. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's fascinating. I think one of the things that's really neat about the Ohio River Valley and right there in Point Pleasant in Gallipolis, Ohio, is that it's so different from the terrain. I mean, really just a handful of miles up the road where you start getting into foothills and then mountains. It's totally different than the other areas in West Virginia, at least that I've been to.
There is, you know, 60 miles upriver from, up the Kanawha River from Point Pleasant, you do have that high concentration of burial mounds in the South Charleston and Dunbar area. They're also spread out all the way to the river, and then you know once you get to the high river, you had more mounds on both sides of the river. There, what Bill said about the wandering spirits, maybe that's very plausible. I don't know. It's a very unique area. You really can't get there on interstate. It's just kind of this peninsula that's out. It's kind of like nearly by itself. It's just things about the geography of the area are very odd.
Well, you know, if you continue up river, I don't know exactly where the Elk River comes in, but there was another bridge collapse. I don't remember the exact year. It was 1907 or 8, 6, something like that. But it also occurred on December 15th, which is quite odd. It was a smaller bridge, not a lot of people on it, but some school children died during it. And
Have you been to that conference? Have you been to that confluence of rivers where that bridge went down?
No, I have not. I have not. And
I don't mean to interrupt, but we went there both of the last two times we were in West Virginia, October of last year and then when we were just there a month ago. And the first time that we went to Charleston and we found the confluence of the rivers, I was pulled to that confluence like nobody's business. I mean, we got out of our 4x4 and I got out and I ran to the intersection of the rivers. And the ladies had noticed that there were like homeless tents that were put together, like a tent community of people that were living underneath the bridge. And I just went running like right to the rivers. And I'm a guy that's not like really terrified by water. But for me to go running towards the intersection of a couple of rivers is weird. It's like it pulled me there. It was really, really bizarre. And we had went and done some ghost box sessions in the vicinity of that area too. And the energy and the vibes that we got from that were off the charts, crazy powerful. I've never experienced anything like it before. There's something going on in Charleston. There absolutely is.
Well, there's been a lot of reports in that area. I mean, it's just around, I guess, the area kind of north of there used to be called Mound, but a lot of the mounds have been destroyed. But, yeah, I think that there's a lot of – and also, I went to a place with Rosemary Ellen Guiley and John and Tim Frick just a little bit west there, across Lanes, which is where Tad Jones had that bizarre sighting of sort of a retro UFO in the I talked about in the Mothman Prophecies. And we talked to some people on the property there that in this holler right near where they lived, they had – all, you know, strange creatures. They had classic UFO sightings, shadow people, and this family was telling. They were telling us these stories, and they were finishing each other's sentences. It wasn't like, you know, let's fool these northern boys. You know, tell them a tale. They had, for all their lives, had been having bizarre experiences there, and the guy's brother wouldn't actually come all the way up to the house because of some of the things that had happened there. It's right near a two-lane highway, a busy two-lane highway. But, yeah, you're right. That whole area seems to be alive with some kind of energy.
We literally had the feeling of being lifted out of our foreheads, like where the third eye is.
Yeah.
When we were in that area a couple different times, I mean, it was – I've never experienced anything like that anywhere else that I've ever been.
Wow.
Bill, what do you think that signifies with the, you know, your third eye is activated, you know, becomes more observant, you know, whatever the term is, you know, what do you think that is saying about you?
I think that's a really interesting question. There's a part of me that is like Fox Mulder. I want to believe. You know, I absolutely want to believe in these different manifestations of paranormal phenomena. I mean, I'm a huge, huge fan. And I love, you know, investigating things that are unknown. And I like to know where those roads take you. We never quite really figure out where they're going. I mean, you get signals, and they're typically scrambled, and you get bits and pieces of this and that. And I think you can add them up. But I think that one thing that you have to be really careful of that, you know, Keel liked to say was that belief is the enemy of truth. So when you're really trying to seek out, you know, whatever answers might be out there, I think to go back to your question with the whole third eye, I don't know a whole lot about that aspect of things, but it's where the pineal gland is. And the pineal gland, in my understanding of it, which is extremely limited, is it's like your extrasensory perception, like the seeding of your extrasensory perception for those of us that have it. My wife, Jackie, has been practicing psychic exercises lately, and one that was given to her by a friend of ours last week was that you should sit down and visualize a certain area and then, you know, have your husband, meaning me, place something on the table in his office or on his desk, and then you sit down and you draw, you know, what you see. And so she sits down in a technique of what I would almost call like automatic writing. She begins to start drawing things as she kind of sees them in her third eye, not knowing really what's going on my desk. And she's done this for the last several days. This is a new practice. But she's picking up signals of what's on my desk and drawing like shadows of what's there. And then when she goes and mirrors it and does a drawing of what's actually there, it's there. So I guess my thought about psychic development and things of that nature, I think we all have the innate tendency to be able to utilize that part of our brains, but so many of us don't stop to take the time to actually practice it and develop it. For me, when I was doing the ghost box sessions that we did when we were in Charleston, to be able to pick up different vibes and such that I'd never experienced anywhere else, kind of tells me that maybe I've got something to do with what's going on, but I think that there's really more that's happening within the environment that is inspiring me. And as the perceiver of that or the percipient, then I'm kind of interacting with that a little bit, but not to the degree that of what I experienced. I know that was external. That wasn't something that I personally generated, if that answers your question.
Okay. It does answer my question. It's just, you know, slowly becoming more knowledgeable, acknowledging that there is some kind of otherworldly phenomenon in that area. I don't know. I understand where you're going with it. Steve, do you think Rosemary had an explanation for, like, Bill's example, or but she knew John Keel?
Oh yeah, they were a good friend.
Yeah. Rosemary has also written, you know, pretty extensively about many other West Virginia cryptids and anomalies. Did she have an explanation that for any of this phenomenon?
No, actually, yes, she was, and I'm not sure I agreed with her completely, but she was on the track of the jinn from Islamic tradition. And there is a lot to that. I think it was Gordon Crichton that first brought up this idea, at least the first Westerner. It's a more, if you go toward the East, it's an idea that many people have, think that UFO pilots and so forth perhaps are jinn. And Gordon Crichton introduced the idea in Flying Saucer Review back in the early 80s. The next one to pick up the mantle was Anne Druffel, and she talks about the jinn in her book called How to Avoid Alien Abduction, or something like that. And the book's a satire, but it's not. She deals with people, again, a lot of people that are very traumatized by their experience, but she's given examples of how they've been able to break the abduction experience, sometimes through righteous indignation or whatever. And she does have a chapter on the jinn. And then it was Rosemary that picked up the mantle from then on. And she does make a case that perhaps this, but I don't know what the jinn are. I mean, are they is it the same thing that John Keel was talking about when he used the term ultra-terrestrial? That was, he used it as kind of a literary device. But I think that was toward the end of her life. That was, and she wrote a couple books on the jinn. She was kind of leaning toward that as that being possibly the source. For me, I think that perhaps the source is still elusive and perhaps manifesting as the jinn in some respects, and other entities, other belief systems, and other. But the last thing is she actually was investigating several hot spots, and she never revealed where they were, but I got the impression they were somewhere near the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border. So there were two or three areas that she was investigating where a lot of different really bizarre things were happening, and she described some of them in her books.
And was the one on the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border near the Kecksburg?
That, you know, I don't know. I just don't know the location. I know that in she wrote the second book that she wrote on the Jinn in America or something like that. She gets into some of the specifics of some of just the bizarre. It's sort of like a mini Skinwalker Ranch, just creepy stuff. And what I was wondering is if we focus on the djinn idea, and Keel, as Bill pointed out, said belief is the enemy. Is if we focus on any one thing, is the phenomena which is reflective and mimics our thoughts sometimes, is it going to shape itself to that end and to kind of lead us along that path of belief? So it's a very tricky prospect to try and get into to hypothesize specifically what it is.
Steve, what you were talking about sounds like the subject of egregores, where the people kind of like think it and it becomes a real entity.
Or like the Philip experiment, the famous Philip experiment in Toronto, I guess, with a group of people. They used a Ouija board, but they meditated on this fictional historical person, and he sort of came to life. The planchette responded to this person and went beyond what they had created. And of course, that's close to what we would call a tulpa as well. But there does seem to be. That doesn't seem to explain everything, but there does seem to be this reflective factor, this paranormal mimicry. And, you can go throughout the history of UFO sightings and see the way they've kind of shaped themselves over the various decades. So, but then again, I don't think that there's one answer to everything. And there's a few things that make me suspect that at least some of this phenomena is, in fact, some kind of physical, flesh and blood, other intelligence, whether it be ET or extra-dimensional. So very hard to sift through all that and figure out, and find out what the lines of demarcation are.
Fascinating. Okay. And you also wanted to, get into... make sure we didn't forget to get cover the trauma from the actual Silver Bridge collapse. And Steve, you have had the opportunity to interview Bill Edmondson. Give us his recollection of that day.
Yeah, when I met him with a friend, John Lee, we had gone down for the 2017 remembrance ceremony, the 50-year anniversary of the bridge collapse. And they had the ceremony in downtown Point Pleasant. They read the names of the 46 people that lost their lives. Well, the next day, this whole day was, talk about serendipity. I mean, I could do a show on how amazing this day went. We walked down to what was the Bridge Museum. I'm sorry, the River Museum. And it had a fire and they're rebuilding it. But it covered the history of the commerce and everything of the ships and everything that went on at the rivers there, and with beautiful models and they had a mock-up of the Silver Bridge, and showed you where the 13th I bar was that failed. But we had never been there, so we decided to walk down. This incredible man, he was there with the support of his family. He came up from North Carolina to show his respects to those that had died on the bridge. He was 88, which means he was 38 when he was crossing the bridge. He was hauling material to be taken to Detroit, so he was coming from the West Virginia side to the Ohio side, and it was going to a tire plant. That's what he was hauling. And he told us that, now you have to picture this, December 15th, It's almost 20 below. The sun's almost down. The bridge that was built in the 20s, which was not meant for this kind of traffic, it's filled with rush hour traffic and Christmas traffic. And so he told us that if you can imagine the span of the bridge, all of a sudden it started wobbling back and forth. And it tipped so far that he had to hold on to the steering wheel to stay in place. And then everything gave way. His truck hit the water. He was forced through the passenger window, right arm first. He showed us he still was not able to straighten out his arm. He had a pin in there. He went through the window, and the good news was that the currents were he went to the bottom, but the currents were pulling him up. But to the force of hitting the water, his pants were pulled down, and they didn't fall off because if you remember what 1960s pant cuffs were like, they didn't clear his shoes, which is almost comical, except debris from the bridge or the truck or something hit, grabbed his pants and started to pull him back under. So he had to, you know, just imagine this, the frigid temperatures of the water, you think you're getting to the surface and he's pulled back under. He finally kicks himself loose. He comes to the surface. There's a bunch of this material that he was hauling is floating on the water, right arm useless. His left arm he puts through a slit in this material. And, you know, talk about the theme of trauma and what goes on in your mind when this happens. He looks up at the top of this massive material, and there's a bird perched up there, which he assumed, you know, had it probably had her nest under the bridge and is just as discombobulated as he is. And they're kind of looking at each other, or at least he was imagining the bird was looking at him. And then, fortunately, everybody that had a boat or was out there on a boat mobilized and to save people, pull people up out of the water. And, you know, people were coming to the surface. Some people never made it. And fortunately, a tugboat captain spotted Bill, intercepted his flow downriver, and pulled him up out of the water, probably moments before he would have died of hypothermia. So what a story, you know. And I'd never heard anyone tell a story like that, in one-on-one.
That's amazing.
Did Bill have a survivor's guilt? You know,
he didn't really express it, but you know, he was faced with, you know, why me? Why was I spared? And he wasn't unscathed, obviously. And they rushed him to the hospital. They put heat on him. He's mentioned in one of the many articles that Jeff Lonsley has portrayed in the museum, which is just, the museum is so well done. One postscript to that, apparently he, you know, that event didn't stop him from driving, or at least for a while. 5 years later, he was in a terrible truck accident. He was not hurt physically too badly, but he was trapped in the cab of this truck for 3 hours. And he said he swore if he ever got out of this, he would never drive a truck again, and he never did.
Yeah. Wow.
But apparently that first experience wasn't enough to stop him from, you know, being a truck driver.
Keel does talk about, you know, towards the end of the Mothman Prophecies, that many people had to be treated for shock. I mean, it really just seems like it was a early 1967. It was almost like the Twin Towers type of scene where all the bystanders were aghast at you know, the bridge just is no longer there. And you see all this stuff going on in the river.
Well, you remember the chapter in that chapter that he deals with the bridge collapse. I had read it several times, but it wasn't. And I was down in Point Pleasant in briefly in 1977 to see the area. But after I had been there in 2006 at the first Mothman Festival and, you know, met the people. And then when I reread that chapter, it just had a different, it certainly had a different flavor. Can I ask Bill a question?
Sure.
You know, when we talk about this, and I think, you know, we Carolyn Harris, how do you assess her, this great lady that suffered great tragedy with losing her little boy on the bridge collapse, yet years later, she's instrumental in bringing this festival to town to help revitalize the community. I mean, what an amazing lady.
You know, Steve, thanks for bringing that up, because honestly, Carolyn is the inspiration for the study. I mean, she absolutely is. Jackie and I traveled to Point Pleasant the first time, and as far as we knew, probably the only time that we'd ever go, back in 2016. And we had the opportunity as we pulled into town. It was after 5 o'clock on a Friday night, and the Mothman Museum was closed, and we didn't know anything else about Point Pleasant except for the TNT area and that the legend occurred there. But we walked across, and Jackie was a postmaster, so the post office is right across the street. So she's in the process of scouting that out. And then she looks across the street from the post office, and there's a little restaurant there that says Harris's Steakhouse. And there's a little old lady who was standing in the window, and she was looking out, and Jackie was looking in, and Jackie said to me, "I think that lady wants us to come in and talk to her." And I'm like, "Yeah, well, you know, maybe. I guess we're in town here. We're 500 miles away. The museum's closed. We don't know anybody. Let's go say hello." So we began visiting with Carolyn, and I'm not kidding you. We were in town for 5 days the first time. We went to her restaurant every single day. She was the warmest, friendliest, most conversational person. When you sat down with Carolyn Harris, you felt like you were sitting with your grandmother or somebody, you know, who basically was family to you. And it felt like that with her immediately. So I think to answer your question, Steve, Carolyn lost her son, 3 years old, and her ex-husband in the bridge disaster. And she embraced the community. She made her restaurant a safe haven. If people didn't have money to pay for their dinner, she would give them dinner for free and say, "Hey, pay me back when you get a chance, or if you don't worry about it." She was just a loving, caring, giving, warm person. And she is, to me, the epitome of what we're studying in post-traumatic growth, because I can't even imagine the pain that she felt. Timmy wasn't the only child she lost. She lost another child as well. So she lost both of her kids at very, very young ages. Yet she turned her life almost into a mission to help put Point Pleasant back on the map and welcome people from all over the world to that little community and just look at what she's been able to be a part of. So, I mean, to me, she's amazing. I get chills talking about it. I just loved her. In fact, Steve knows this. We met Carolyn in 16. And on Christmas Eve, we were headed to my mother-in-law's for Christmas Eve dinner. And I told Jackie, because Carolyn had given us her phone numbers, I said, "Let's call Carolyn. Let's see if we can interview her and maybe do a book about her story." The next day, she had a heart attack, and the next day she died. Yeah. So I was crushed. We were both heartbroken. But since then, we've returned to Point Pleasant, largely because of what she inspired in us. And that's where our study has come from, is her. I mean, she was just a wonderful, wonderful, warm person. I'm so grateful that I got a chance to know her for a few days.
It was like walking into mom's kitchen at home every time I walk into a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, with a total of 46 people who died all of a sudden, what have you learned about how such a large loss of sudden loss of life has on, you know, just like one of those small river towns, you know, probably, you know, a lot of the people make their living through farming. Usually places like that are, you know, fairly close-knit communities. How does a community deal with such a large loss of life?
They just banded together. They just came together. The folks that we interviewed talked about the overwhelming nature of West Virginians and basically said that if there's somebody who's going through something, there are half a dozen other somebodies who are there to support them. And one of the things that we learned in our interview process from two or three of the people that we talked to was that there was a young boy, I mean, a really, really young boy, like a year and a half old, who had lost a significant portion of his digestive tract. And the only way he was going to be able to have a life that was somewhat close to normal was if another child were to lose their life, but be able to donate the organs that this guy needs. And these three folks that we talked to who brought this up to us just talked about the overwhelming support that the community gave to the people, you know, who were there and needed it, and this little boy included. And another, you know, another dimension of post-traumatic growth that's emerging from our study is, you know, spirituality. It's people having a faith in a higher benevolent being, you know, a God that takes care of them. And then their faith, the way that a couple of the folks illustrated how it had grown as a result of witnessing what happened here. And I got to say that one of the guys who probably was the most powerful interview that we did was a gentleman by the name of Jimmy Wedge. And Jimmy Wedge was the basketball coach, his first head coaching game the night the bridge went down. And he knew his mom was going to come to the game, but he didn't know his dad was coming in from out of town to surprise him at the game, and they both lost their lives on the bridge. And so he illustrated to us so much of this. I mean, this guy is so resilient. It's unbelievable. He's served a couple terms in state Congress and done all kinds of neat things in his businesses. And he's 79 years old, and he just was a delight to interview. So the positive attitude that he had as a result of, you know, going through that trauma of losing both parents, and having to have, like you mentioned a couple times, Mark, that survivor's guilt. Here he is, you know, performing as a head coach for the first time. Mom and dad are coming to support him. Mom and dad don't make it. But still, what a wonderful story he had.
You know, Bill, what you were saying about a greater sense of spirituality in Jeff's The Facts Behind the Legend, you know, Linda does talk about she had this need to discuss it with a minister, and then just to give listeners a preview about next week's show is you know, Michael's going to be talking about some of the traits that emerge after an experience of some unexplained nature. And one of the changes that frequently happens to someone is that there is this sudden need to serve humanity. Do something for the greater good, you know, like one of those types of philosophies. And you and Steve did talk about Carolyn Harris. And you know, if you could pay, that's great. If you can't, next time you're in town, you know, hopefully you could pay your bill. But she seemed to have this that type of experience after the bridge collapse. So, you know, I think we are seeing a little bit of a this pattern emerging.
Yeah.
Just up one. Oh, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was just going to point out one other thing here, and then I'll pass it back to you, Steve. Resilience. You know, if I can get through this, mm-hmm. you better believe I can get through that. And just the strength that it gives people, that inner, you know, fortitude, to be able to having navigated this horrible catastrophe, that you can be there for others, you can help others as they go through it, which helps you to grow. And like you mentioned, that giving back is just, it's huge. It's just huge.
And one thing that occurred to me is, Bill, when you were talking about, well, the resilience and the way that everybody came together to support everybody after this tragedy. Carolyn's building was not exactly up to code, but building inspector that came in knew what a force she was for the community. And I wish I could remember the specifics of the story, but they did whatever they could to make sure that Carolyn would pass. I mean, they weren't letting go any kind of a dangerous situation, but I guess you could say they weren't dotting every I and crossing every T, because they wanted to make sure that Carolyn, you know, stayed in business and didn't have to pay out a ton of money, because she was not a wealthy woman, and here she's giving, you know, so much to the community and such a great support to the community that even the dastardly building inspectors were being kind and supportive.
Bill, is, you know, Steve mentioned that the eye bolt, you know, there's a replica of one at the Mothman Museum. But we know there was a structural failure, and you know, there's too much modern traffic on a older bridge, and that seems to be the most plausible explanation.
They said there was a defect in the 13th eyeballs. It was a manufacturing defect that I guess was sort of laying in wait. But you know, something very positive came out of this. And when they had the remembrance ceremony, they had somebody speak to the fact that this had been the worst bridge tragedy in history, and it changed the way everybody looks at these bridges and the regulations and so forth. And it's likely that because of the attention given to older buildings and new construction, it's very likely that many other tragedies have been presented in the wake of the Point Pleasant tragedy. So at least, you know, you've got another story of some, you know, positive coming out of a negative, and similar in the way that Carolyn and Jeff Wansley created a Mothman Festival. Even though it's history, you know, the Mothman and the stuff that went on, even if there's no direct connection in everybody's psyche, the bridge collapse and everything else is connected. Even though I don't believe this Mothman apparition, whatever it was, caused the bridge collapse, it doesn't matter. It happened in that same year, and that's all, you know, all it takes to sort of put them together in one's mind.
And to kind of piggyback on that, Steve, the prophecies that Gil received of basically a chemical plant blowing up. Those were the things that he was thinking was going to be the major disaster that was going to take place on the Ohio River from the information he was receiving. He just wasn't able to put two and two together and figure out
and,
that the bridge was going to go.
And remember the silliness of the thing is, Mark, all these prophecies were coming together from people that didn't know each other, and it was going to be some kind of an EM effect, whatever that meant. And it was going to happen. Finally, they said, well, it's going to happen December 15th. President Johnson's going to light the Christmas tree lights. There'll be 3 days of darkness. I think maybe the Pope was going to be assassinated or whatever. So, but at that almost that same moment, that's when the bridge collapsed. So it was just, this is, you know, bringing it back into the high strangeness, the paranormal. You get this, you get a warning, but it's like the trickster did it. They gave you the wrong warning. You were looking in the wrong direction. Something's going to happen, but you know. And again, like Bill said, Kiel thought a chemical plant was going to blow, and you know, everybody's looking in the wrong direction. So you know that's really frustrating. What does that mean? What does that tell you about the whole scope of this thing?
Okay, and yeah, that Willow Island cooling tower happened about a decade later up the river, but you know, there was a huge accident, just not related to this 1966-67 time period. But in the course of your research, is there a similarity or difference in the way people process trauma? Is there a better recovery rate if the experience was man-made versus a natural disaster? Because, you know, we do have, you know, since I live in the same river valley, you know, dealing with catastrophic flooding. You know, those stories from the 30s still are around today. But it you know, like the Johnstown flood happened maybe about a 3-hour drive from me. You know, that's still 130 years later, it's still one of those regional disasters that is discussed. Is there difference in the way people respond to man-made or natural disasters?
You know, I think we talked about that a little bit last night, Mark, when we were getting to know each other. And there's a terminology for that known as the shattering of cognitive schemas. It's the way that we interpret the world. So regardless of whether or not it's a man-made trauma, like let's say the Twin Tower disaster, or if it's the Silver Bridge going down, which is not necessarily a natural disaster, but kind of in the middle of a natural disaster and a man-made thing. It's a man-made component that failed, or maybe it's the tsunami and things like that happen. You know, when we talk about the bridge itself, and you use that as an example because that's primarily what we're talking about, I'm going across this bridge. You know, I'm maybe 35 years old. I've been across this bridge for the last 20 years almost in my life, driving a car, and mom and dad took me across it even before that on a regular basis. I have no reason to believe it's going to collapse. I have no reason to believe it's going to fail. That's just not not even something I can even process or even think about processing. So when it actually does happen, and let's say that I'm this lady, Linda, who I was talking about earlier, as she approaches it, the reality of the situation manifests slowly. At first, there's the shock. Where's the bridge? You know, I know this bridge. I can depend upon this bridge. I always go over this bridge. Then the bridge is gone. And it dawns on you that the bridge is gone, but you're trying to make sense of what that might mean. And then you start thinking, wait a second, there probably were people on that bridge. And now all of a sudden emergency crews are coming. People are in danger. People are dying. And as this is dawning on you, I don't know that there's a big difference between, you know, a man-made disaster or if it's an earthquake. Because, I mean, to me, if it's your cognitive schema, if it's your way of perceiving the world, and this is outside of that reality, then the trauma itself, it's going to manifest, I think, in a similar way. I think it's going to manifest in a similar way, regardless of what man-made or not.
Okay.
I wonder. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Steve. I'll make a comment rejoinder.
All right. I just wondered, Bill, if it's a situation where it's a man-made disaster, but it's due to negligence or some faulty construction.
Yep.
And there's blame, and that kind of another component where it's not just happenstance. It's not a tsunami. It's not unforeseen. You can actually point in the direction of the guilty party.
And I was thinking that, too, as I was trying to explain that and understand it myself, because I think if there is somebody to blame, then you can objectify what happened, and you can say,
right,
this is the cause. Now, how dare you mess up my life like this? You took my loved ones away from me. So that's
right.
A whole different level of, you know, processing trauma and understanding the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I think you two have done a terrific job of, you know, recreating this horrific scene, helping us to visualize all of a sudden the bridge is there and then it isn't, how people responded, people got out to save lives in boats promptly. From what I understand, there were two bodies that were never recovered.
That's right.
That's another aspect. There was not a closure for two families, which makes that scene. Even more devastating. I don't know how. That type of trauma could be overcome. That would have to be very difficult, and that might.
Well, there's another. Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, maybe that's why the reading of the names at the World Trade Center memorial service is so powerful, is, you know, so many people were never found.
One of the people who lost their lives in the Silver Bridge disaster was a girl by the name of Kathy Bias. And I actually have the Images of America Silver Bridge Disaster of 1967 book right here with me. I literally read this evening before we got on show here, because a couple folks that I interviewed talked about Kathy Bias. What I didn't know about her, and having never been found, was that I think her mom and a sibling were also lost in the bridge disaster. They did recover them. So So I think, yeah, absolutely. How horrible that would be to never, never find that little girl's remains. I just think that what an open-ended wound that would be for forever, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the, you know, seeing the newspaper articles in the museum, it's interesting. Some of the displays are a lot of fun. But, you know, there's also the video of the movie, and it really does hit home about the trauma the town experienced. But you two have given many examples where people are resilient. In the Mason County, people are resilient, and you know, just humanity can overcome these types of just terrible disasters.
You know, I could to add to that, Mark, when we talked to Jimmy Wedge, you know, Jimmy talked about another way to, one of the questions we asked him was, if counseling services were available back then, do you think you would have sought them out? And his answer was no. He said, because I had family. I had brothers and sisters. I had community members. I had friends. We talked through this stuff. We worked through this stuff together. You know, that's one of the things we did. And that it was just, it showed to the resilience of the community. And I think that one of the things that Jackie and I noticed 5 years ago, the very first time we went to Point Pleasant, was that people not only were kind to one another, they were really kind to us. And we live in the greater Chicagoland area where, I mean, if people aren't trying to cut you off on the highway, they're not really talking to you. So it's worse there in that area of West Virginia than it is where we live in the community. Is just so, I mean, really blessed to have that type of cohesiveness, because you don't see that in other parts of the country as prevalent as you do there. One thing I did want to share with you guys also and with the audience is that in the interviews that we did, the most vivid memory that came out to many people that we interviewed was of that man who was on top of the trailer as it was floating down the river and approaching the confluence of the Kanawha and the Ohio rivers. That was a vivid, vivid memory that these people, I mean, some of them said, you know, I don't ever even, there's not a day that goes by that I don't picture that, or that I don't think of the bridge disaster in general, which is just really pretty powerful.
Well, do you guys remember the opening scene of the Mothman Prophecies, where a very tired John Keel is catching a whale of a cold, and he and Mary Heyer, the car has gone off the road. He's trying to find a phone so he can call a tow truck. And there's a couple that comes to the door and sees this man dressed in black with a beard, very out of place in that area. And he talked about how this couple perished on the Silver Bridge, and that it became an element of folklore. Well, for the longest time, I thought John Keel just used that as a literary device. It turns out not. There's an interview in, I think, one of the John Keel collections called The Great Phonograph in the Sky, where I forget who's interviewing him. It's one of the old interviews that where he actually came across that piece of folklore when he was in West Virginia one time. And it turned out he was the one that created the folklore. And, in fact, these two people, whose name he didn't remember, did perish on the Silver Bridge.
But we don't know who they are, Steve, or do you know who
I do not know who they are. They were asked him, and he said he did not know who it was. I just, all those years, I thought that Keel was just using it as a literary device to open the book. And what he was doing is showing how sometimes very mundane, ordinary things can be misinterpreted as some kind of a bizarre paranormal experience. So I just thought that was fascinating that it was in fact real and did piece of folklore in that part of West Virginia.
I'm going to have to dig and try to figure out who that married couple was.
Right. There must be a way, because it would have been somebody that lived back in those hollers there down by probably around Gallipolis Ferry, you know, down south there along Route 2 or maybe 35.
I don't think that there were that many married couples who both died in the disaster.
You know, that's a good point. That's a good point.
I mean, the first one that comes to mind are Jimmy Wedge's parents. But I don't think it was that.
Right. Okay.
Just to, you know, kind of change topics a little bit. As far as I know, the Van Meter Visitor Conference is still going on.
Yes, and that is the last weekend. It's always the last weekend in September, the weekend following the Mothman Festival, and it commemorates the Week of Terror, as Chad Lewis calls it, as he takes you on the walking tour through town with a very strange winged creature that was seen in 1903 in Van Meter, Iowa, which is just west of Des Moines.
Okay.
And then the next weekend, I'm going to be speaking at the Bray Road Conference in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. And I'll be talking about the Shaver mystery at the Van Meter Conference, which is a whole other story. Very, very interesting period of history. Amazing stories, Ray Palmer and Richard Shaver. And then I'll be talking about the paranormal aspects of cryptids at the Bray Road Conference.
Okay. You're familiar with the Van Meter flying humanoid. You know, with the Week of Terror that the townspeople experienced in 1903, was there any kind of overlap with how the Point Pleasant citizenry reacted 63 years later? I'm just kind of looking is there like a normal, are we seeing, you know, just typical normal human behavior with unusual circumstances?
With shotguns, this was actually several prominent people in the town saw, a very small town. This was more of a pterodactyl kind of a creature, but, you know, in keeping with John Keel and his, transmogrifications of energy, this thing seemed to have a beak, and it seemed to have a light on the end of the beak, or a horn on the beak. And also there was one case where it seemed to exude a vapor, insert your own joke there, but the witness actually lost time or was in a trance or something like that. So here you have a creature that strangely manifests a light, and there's missing time involved. It's, you know, there are humanoid reports. There are other types of creature reports that have some of the same manifestations, missing time and some kind of a light. Either they're holding the light or a light on their chest. It's been suggested that perhaps as Keel thought, the manifestation may not be the most interesting thing. We have to find out the cosmic mechanism behind these manifestations. So it's a very, it just lasted for about a week. A guy that became the bank manager saw it. He was waiting in the bank one night because they saw this light on top of the building. They thought it was a robber at first, and a couple people blasted at this thing with shotguns, and it didn't affect it. It's kind of like the early beginnings of the Mothman Festival. Great people there. Just a really phenomenal time.
Every once in a while you read about these cases, like there's a light, you know, the Mothman's red eyes, what you were talking about, the some kind of glowing from the Van Meter
right.
When you and Zelia were with us last, I think Zelia was talking about the Flatwoods Monster kind of had like a glowing head. There's like this kind of like a element of the bioluminescent creature. What's the deal with that?
I don't know. The in Ording, Washington, Sally Shepard Wolford, who wrote Valley of the Skookum, she's the mother of the famous Bigfoot researcher Autumn Williams. They saw what looked like flesh and blood Bigfoots, but they also saw Bigfoots that seemed to glow at night, and sometimes they seemed to be translucent. Of course, there have been, 7-foot silver humanoids that were also translucent. So I don't know. There's a high strangeness component to so many of these things that, some of the patterns show up, and perhaps we shouldn't be so, I don't know, maybe it's not even worth categorizing what these things look like. You know, if you get into the literature, there are hardly any, in quotes, spaceships that look the same. A lot of the entities, at least before the Greys showed up and messed up everything, we used to have some pretty cool entities back in the old days, and a lot of them didn't look much the same, except maybe they were a little short, but there were also giants. So I don't know, Mark. It's a component that Keel tapped into, and it's just that high strangeness factor that seems to permeate through all this paranormal phenomena.
It's just really fascinating. I think it's one of the reasons
really
why.
Is.
Yeah, I've really gotten more into cryptids recently in the last few years than other topics. It's something I just find really captivating.
It's something that occurred to me here that all of us here. Is there any way we could stop doing this and do something else? I mean, absolutely
no.
Not.
No.
It doesn't matter how frustrating it gets or how many answers we don't have. There's just no way.
Now, there's just something about the cryptids that is really put the hooks into me. You get the the behemoth from the Book of Job. Some of these other native petroglyphs. You have to wonder what were they seeing. There's just a long documentation of animals that don't have a modern day explanation, had some dinosaurs survived up until a more recent time.
Well, look at some of the Nessie-type creatures that aren't just in Loch Ness, but they're in lakes all over the place, including there have been some classic sightings, credible sightings in lakes in Ireland that are only as big as a football field and maybe 20 feet deep. How do a colony of these things survive there? You get this paradox. You get the paradox with the Mothman. It didn't always flap its wings. It just didn't, biologically didn't make any sense. Didn't make any sense as an apparition either. So what the heck was it?
And Linda says in her interview with Jeff that the Mothman had kind of like human, super human characteristics like telepathy.
I don't remember that she feel like she had some. I know she felt. I know in one interview she said she felt sorry for it. It was like it was kind of lost, or something. So perhaps that's where the telepathy came. Oh, go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say, in Shivering and Cold, she said that she felt that it had its wings around off on top of a roof and it was cold.
On page 33, she says to Jeff, the Mothman was smart and knew how close to get to people as to not get hurt. I wanted to talk to it and find out if I could help it, and it seemed to know that. It kept showing up to me.
Here, this lady that was scared to death by it had empathy for it.
Mm-hmm. There seemed to be some kind of two-way communication. There seemed to be some kind of mutual understanding. So, fascinating subject.
It sure is.
Okay, we're getting close to wrapping up the show for tonight. Do you two want to say how people can get a hold of you, websites, anything like that, upcoming appearances?
Go ahead, Bill.
Sure. Well, we were going to be presenting at the Mothman Festival, my team, which is known as Phenomenology Research Partners. We can be found at Phenomenology Research Partners. And on Facebook also, I also have a Facebook page, Bill Kuselis. That's Kuselis with a K. We'd welcome inquiries. We're also looking for additional subject matter when we complete our study on post-traumatic growth and the bridge disaster. We're going to be looking into other areas also. So, yeah, and Mark, thanks for having me.
We're going to have to do this again. All right, so Steve, you want
to... And I think some
we'll
of us
things
are going to be
making
the pilgrimage down to Point Pleasant on that weekend, even though it'll just be that many people. I already mentioned Van Meter and the Bray Road Conference. I'm on the High Strangeness Factor on the Paranormal UK Radio Network and a correspondent on Mac Maloney's Military X-Files on the same network. I have a Facebook page called The Phantom Menagerie. Great to be here with everybody. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. It was very thought-provoking
and a little bit emotional, I might have to say.
Yeah, it was a touching memorial to the people of Mason County. And anyhow, thank you again, and appreciate everyone listening. Thanks, Barbara, and we'll see everyone next week.